Continuing education credits for physicians and other healthcare professionals is provided by VCU Healthcare Continuing Education. Check out cribsiders.vcuhealth.org for more information.
The Cribsiders podcast is for entertainment, education, and informational purposes only. The views and statements expressed on this podcast are solely those of the host.
Welcome back to the Cribsiders. I'm Chris the Chi Manchu, and I'm here with the other wonderful Cribsiders with me, Dr. Sam Mazur, and our producer, Dr. Angela Zhang. Hey, guys. How you doing?
Hey.
I'm enjoying the Seattle sunshine today.
Wonderful. Well, tonight we have our guest, Dr. Jordan Simmons, and he's in our part two of our hyperkalemia series, and today he's talking about chronic hyperkalemia in CKD. But first, before we get into it, Sam's going to remind you about our show.
Thank you so much, Chris. I might as well tell you all that we are the Pediatric Medicine Podcast. We interview leading experts in the field to bring clinical pearls, practice-changing knowledge, and answering your questions about core topics in pediatric medicine.
We'll be talking with our guest, Dr. Jordan Simmons. For those of you who listened to the last episode or need a refresher, he is professor of pediatrics at the University of Washington and an attending nephrologist at Seattle Children's. He's really interested in academic medicine and teaching, and also would love to recruit any interested listeners here to pediatric nephrology. He teaches us about the physiology behind chronic hyperkalemia, balancing pans of medications, and the diet behind CKD.
I hope everyone listens to the episode because I'm sure it won't be too potassium rich for your taste.
Ooh, two for two, Chris. Well done.
Those are all ChatGPT, man.
AI is taking, you'll be out of a job soon.
Out of a bad pun transition job. Welcome back to part two of hyperkalemia. This time we're going to dig deeper into what we can do in chronic kidney disease. Angela, do you want to take us off with, would you like to take it? Take it from here.
Yeah.
Whatever I can say.
Sounds good. So let's talk about a more chronic case of hyperkalemia. So I'll say that you're seeing a patient and they're 9 and they have FSGS and now chronic kidney disease and are followed by nephrology in the outpatient setting. They're due for some labs. You have them drawn and the creatinine comes back at 2 and the potassium is 5.8. And so I guess last time we talked about acute management and being worried about all of these different numbers that are quite elevated. Should I be really worried in this setting, or am I able to take a breath?
Yeah, that's a really good question, and we can get really anxious looking at the reports on the computer. The numbers are all the wrong colors, and sometimes they're bold, and occasionally I even get values back from outside laboratories where it actually says panic value. And I'm not a fan of panic in the hospital or in the care of my patients. It's always better to try to be calm. But there are times that you need to be worried. And I think in the previous episode, we talked about times when you need to be worried, where the patient's cardiac function and risk for arrhythmia is really high, and that's worrisome. Long-term chronic elevations of potassium are always related to problems of excretion, and that's a kidney problem. So there's something wrong with the kidney's ability to be able to get rid of potassium. And we mentioned this a little bit before, so there can be low kidney function, a low glomerular filtration rate, GFR is low, so just potassium is not filtered, doesn't ever get into the tubular, there's not enough distal delivery of anything, and so it's just not leaving the body. You can have tubular dysfunctions, which can lead to this problem as well, remembering the physiology of potassium filtration, reabsorption proximally, and then distal secretion. And that can be because of diseases of the renal tubule or therapies that we give to our patients, which will tend to limit potassium excretion. They're potassium-sparing diuretics that we're familiar with, things that work at the mineralocorticoid receptor, medications like spironolactone or eplerenone, medications that work at the epithelial sodium channel, medications like amiloride or triamterene. All of these will tend to limit the ability of the kidney to get rid of potassium. And there are other medicines that we use a lot, especially in kidney land, right? We use a lot of ACE inhibitors or A2 receptor blockers. These inhibit the renin angiotensin dominance in aldosterone system. So RAS inhibition of any kind will limit the ability to have enough mineralocorticoid, enough aldo, to be able to promote potassium excretion. And a lot of my patients will be on immunosuppressive medications like calcineurin inhibitors. So my kidney transplant patients will be on calcineurin inhibitors as part of their transplant immunosuppression. But we'll also use calcineurin inhibitors for patients who have other types of chronic kidney disease. Sometimes they're used in systemic lupus. Sometimes it's used with heavy proteinuria in nephrotic syndrome. Sometimes it's used in other types of kidney diseases. So you can have a lot of other reasons, either phenomenon related to the kidney itself or to the medications and therapies, which will tend to limit excretion. So this case that you describe is a patient who has a chronic kidney problem. The creatinine is about 2 mg/dL now. So that's a significantly lower than normal creatinine. I would think even if this is a big, very muscular person, 2 is unequivocally too high. And every time you double your creatinine, that's about half the glomerular filtration rate that you had before. So if a normal creatinine is supposed to be, 0.5 for this person, let's just say they're a smaller child, creatinine goes from 0.5 to 1 mg/dL. That's a GFR drop of about 50% from normal. And then it goes to 2, that's another 50% drops, about 25% of normal. That's pretty poor renal function. So the ability to excrete potassium is going to be limited. And then you said that this patient has FSGS or focal segmental glomerulosclerosis. And those are diseases that manifest as nephrotic syndrome. They tend to have heavy proteinuria, these kids. It's a lousy disease. It tends to lead to progressive chronic kidney disease and end-stage renal disease. And we really hate it because it can even lead to recurrence after transplant. Those patients who have persistent nephrotic syndrome that doesn't respond well to medications will often be on a lot of ACE inhibitor or A2 receptor blocker, because we know that one of the beneficial side effects, for lack of a better term, of those medications is to reduce protein excretion because of the way that they make changes in glomerular blood flow, and also because of some direct effects that those medications have on what's called glomerular perm selectivity, the ability of glomerulus to allow protein to slip through, which normally shouldn't be happening. And these drugs seem to make that protein loss a little bit less. So we tend to give these patients as much RAS inhibition as they can hold without making their creatinine go up even further. And if this patient really had bad nephrotic syndrome as a manifestation of their FSGS, they may also be on a calcineurin inhibitor, something like tacrolimus, at the same time. And tacrolimus will tend to limit your potassium excretion because of its effect on decreasing GFR and because of some direct effects on renal tubule. RAS inhibitors will tend to decrease your ability to excrete potassium because of its effect on GFR and the reduction in aldo production that you get downstream from inhibiting RAS. And so all of those things will tend to limit the kidney's ability to excrete potassium, plus the fact that the kid's GFR is not so great in the first place. So this patient has probably lower capacity. So how do we handle that? Probably the most important thing is to change their diet. And so we talked last time about how if you've got pretty normal kidney function, it's almost impossible to overeat your way into hyperkalemia. But if you have diminished kidney function or diminished excretory capacity from the kidney, it's actually pretty easy to make your potassium go up just by taking in too much. So our renal dietitians are very busy talking to our chronic kidney disease patients and reminding them about the low potassium diet that's necessary to make sure that they don't end up hyperkalemic and potentially putting themselves at risk for those acute problems that we talked about previously. But do many of these patients hang out at slightly higher levels? We talked before about how 5.5 milliequivalent per liter is sort of the upper limit of normal. And so I guess by definition, 5.6 would be considered hyperkalemia, but I really wouldn't be too worried about arrhythmia or significant risks at that point. And a lot of my patients with chronic kidney disease are hanging out at 5.6, 5.8. So if this patient shows up and, your question was, do I need to be worried? you may have the advantage of being able to look at all the lab tests that I've been drawing on this patient over the last year or two as they've been followed over the long term in our clinic. If you're working at an outside clinic and you don't have access to my electronic health record, you can give us a call and sort of say, hey, I'm seeing this patient in urgent care. I'm seeing this patient in my office. What do you think? Is there anything I need to be worried about? And I could go and take a look and say, you know, he kind of hangs out here. I think he needs, why don't you send him to my office again? And we're going to have the renal dietitian have another chat with the patient and with the parents about being careful about what's going on. And then we can sort of regroup. So it's actually pretty uncommon in that situation that you've described that you need to be concerned that the patient is at risk now. The patient could be at risk down the road. In the same way that if in your office or in your urgent care in your emergency department, you're seeing a patient for a completely different story, but you notice a high blood pressure, you know, don't blow it off. Contact somebody, you know, contact the PCP if that's not who you are, and sort of say, you know, I noticed something. And maybe you'll follow it up and it'll be nothing. And so this is a situation where you contact the patient's nephrologist and you'd say, hey, I saw this. Is anything we need to be worried about today? Just want to make sure. And the answer would probably be no, but I'd say, thank you for calling. Let's make sure this patient comes into the office. I may have to rejigger the medications. We're definitely going to need to talk about the diet. And we're going to want to trend this in a better direction rather than running the risk of it trending in the wrong direction.
And before we get into the questions that are like, how are we going to trend it? How are we going to do the diet? I just have two questions I want to ask, but I will separate them. The first one is for the benefit of your ACE inhibitors, your ARBs, your ability to essentially decrease filtration through the glomerulus and decrease your proteinuria, what potassium would you tolerate as a nephrologist with your patients?
Oh, I don't even blink if it's less than 6.
Okay.
So 5.9, it's like that's another day at the office. And then when it's 6 or 6.1, and this is, okay, I'll have to, true caveat that this is my opinion and my experience here. I don't think there is any literature to tell you what's going on. But when it gets to be 6 or 6.1, then I look at context and I ask myself, did I just go up on the ACE? Did I just double the lisinopril dose? In which case I may say to myself, maybe that was a mistake and I got to back up. Or I have some patients who must have that dose of lisinopril because they are hypertensive and profoundly nephrotic and I got to do everything I can to get their blood pressure under control and reduce their protein excretion. And in that situation, when I see the potassium was previously 5.7, 5.8, and it's now 6 to 6.1, I might not say I have to reduce the lisinopril. I might say, guess what? I'm adding diuretics to your regimen. And I might actually put that patient on a thiazide diuretic. If the GFR is really poor, I might even put them on low-dose furosemide because I need to augment their excretory capacity with diuretics because I need the benefits of those other drugs which are causing problems. So I think it's very context-driven. And I think you need to look and if you have access to trends, and if you know the patient and you know what's going on, you can make those judgments. For people who maybe are interfacing with the patient at random times in an emergency department, in urgent care, in a general office, always the best thing if you're unsure and it looks a little weird, give us a call because it's the collaboration which makes sure the patient gets the right care.
Awesome. So as a nephrologist that already has a trend of elevated potassium, something less than 6 seems reasonable. My second question is, you've already kind of touched on this already, but some of the physiology. So why do these patients who have consistently been at 5.8, for example, 5.9, even 6.0, why do they have a lower risk of arrhythmia? And again, I know you touched on it already, but I just want to like really hammer that home.
It seems to be that just over time, the membrane is kind of used to this. There's probably intracellular phenomenon as well, so that these relationships are a little bit more stable. Can a chronic kidney disease patient develop an arrhythmia with higher potassium? They absolutely can. There's no doubt about it. So again, when it gets to 6 or above, I'm still probably going, I would really rather it be a little bit lower. But most of my patients who seem to have chronic hyperkalemia, there's still a little bit of buffer, even if they're at 5.8 to 6, because the risk of arrhythmia is not as high even with a patient who acutely is up in the 6 range. There are certain phenomena that can make your risk of arrhythmia higher. And remember, we talked last time when we were talking about giving calcium for membrane stabilization of the cardiac membrane, that it's the relationship between potassium and calcium levels. So a hypocalcemic patient with a slightly high potassium level is going to be at more risk. And unfortunately, many of my chronic kidney disease patients are at risk for hypocalcemia because they have disorders of vitamin D metabolism. It's part of their chronic kidney disease, and they can end up a little bit on the hypocalcemic side. So their risk is there. And I think we can't be glib about it. And, you know, for years I've been saying, treat your patient, not the numbers. And a high potassium is one of the few numbers that you really do have to treat, but you're still treating your patient. And so while I may not be worried about most people, 5.9, if I see 6 to 6.1, I'll say, how does that fit together? There'll be some patients where I'll see 6.1, I'll say, wait a minute, the total calcium is coming back at 7.2 milligrams. Per deciliter. That's just, this doesn't smell right. And I may call that patient back for lab testing that day. And I may call a family depending on what else is going on, learn what's happening clinically. And I've had a couple patients where normally I would say that number doesn't worry me too much. Well, say, you know, I don't like the way this feels. And it would be better for you to come to the emergency department for assessment.
And just the last practical tip along those lines, and it's okay if you can't necessarily give this answer, but how many months would you say and or years would you have to be certainly stable at that number with which you would say that's a chronic situation? Like if I look back at your trends and I'm the primary care doctor, and I'm like, all right, you've been doing this for 2 months. Is that good enough to say this is stable, or should I be really seeing a 6 to 1 year trend?
I think it's measured in months. I don't think it's measured in days. I don't think it has to be years. And I would probably say if somebody's been hanging out there for probably the last 3 to 6 months, probably that's okay. But I'd also think, you know, nephrologists think a lot about trends. And so if the rate of rise is extremely rapid, so if the patient was hanging, I have chronic kidney disease patients whose potassiums are low because they have renal tubular dysfunction and they're leaking a lot of potassium, and it's hard to keep up with them. So if it's gone from 3.5 to 4.5 to 5.5 to 6.5, yeah, that could have been over months, but that trend, I don't like that rate. But if it's been pretty consistently between 5.5 and 5.8 for the last 6 months, during the period of time that the creatinine has been, you know, 1.6 to 1.8, the GFR calculates out at around, you know, 50 mils a minute. That's a pretty stable patient. It's probably okay. But certainly in at our hospital, the answer would be just call me. I'd rather get the call. And I think anyone on my team would rather get the call. And hopefully if you're working in general care with pediatric patients, you have been able to build a relationship with your nephrology team to be able to make those calls too.
Can we talk a little bit about the diet? So you had mentioned, hey, my nutritionist is going to be the one, or I apologize, not your nutritionist, but one of the nutritionists who work with the team. But one of the nutritionists is going to say, hey, this is what you should be doing. Are there certain patients that have an increased risk of becoming hyperkalemic because of their diet, and or what should we be doing from a dietary standpoint?
Yeah, no, it's a really good question. Again, the physiology is going to be one of anybody who has a diminished excreting capacity. So those are going to be people with low glomerular filtration rates, maybe people who have renal tubular dysfunction of a lack of excretion, as opposed to the leaky renal tubule that you can see in some of my patients. Certain medications, which are going to cause these problems, and then the really rare kids who have like some sort of genetic problem, like the pseudohypoaldosteronism, which we alluded to very briefly in the previous episode. So you sort of know that these are patients who are at risk. And if you're aware of that and you've noticed the trends a little bit upwards, or you just realize because their GFR is so low and they're on all these medications, they're going to be at risk, that's when we start to talk about changes in diet. And so the low potassium diet is one to think about. And it's a shame because, you know, there's a lot of potassium in fresh fruits and vegetables, which we'd really like kids to be able to eat. And sometimes we have to be really, really strict about that. And I, you know, there's nothing, you know, worse as a parent than to be able to tell another set of parents that, hey, you know, you've worked hard to get your kid to eat their fruits and vegetables, and I'm going to tell you that you can't, or you can only have a few. Potatoes have a lot of potassium in it, it turns out. So those are things that you have to think about. Some soft drinks have a lot. There's a lot of phosphorus in some of those other foods as well. And there's some tricks that we can think about. You can take potatoes and actually soak them. It leaches out some of the potassium into the water. And So, you know, maybe the potassium level will go down a little bit, but mostly it's about restrictions. Those are things that you have to think about. It can get tricky for infants who are on formula. Breast milk turns out to be relatively low in potassium. It's the best renal formula for babies is breast milk. So that's a good thing. We don't have to go artificial. We can stay with breast milk, which is best anyway. And then there is a there's one infant formula out there that happens to be low in potassium and in phosphorus that was designed specifically for children with renal dysfunction. So there is an artificial formula available if breast milk is not available. We sometimes have to go that route for the infants. There was a period of time where we would occasionally take formulas, add sodium polystyrene sulfonate to the formula, stir, and then let it all settle out and decant the formula off, leaving the sludge at the bottom with supposedly all the potassium connected to it. I'm wondering if my nutrition colleagues are learning how to do that with some of the newer medications, pentamer or sodium zirconium cyclosilicate. I realize I don't know that. I'm going to have to find that out. But you know, if the GFR is low, it's going to get lower. And so teaching people the diet early is necessary for the long-term care of a person with chronic kidney disease. If you still see problems, we'll occasionally add diuretic to the regimen, which we sort of mentioned beforehand, that can augment losses. But usually that's because the kidney function is getting worse and worse over time, and potassium management gets harder. But then maybe fluid volume management is also getting harder. Maybe acid-base management is getting harder because chronic kidney disease people develop metabolic acidosis, and that doesn't help your potassium management, as we talked about in the previous episode. And so we have to give base replacement, and that might help a little bit with your potassium management, but it might cause other problems because you're eating sodium bicarbonate, and that adds problems to your volume status and your blood pressure. And we keep trying to keep things in balance, but if renal function continues to get worse and it's harder and harder to manage all of those phenomena, including the potassium management, that's a reason that you sometimes have to say, you know, it's time to think about starting dialysis. And that's among the indications to get started for dialysis care, is when the conservative management of all of those imbalances, particularly hyperkalemia, becomes too challenging.
And so I was hoping to talk a little bit about management in this case. You know, we talked about a lot about management in the acute setting, and now we have the management in the chronic setting where we feel like we have a little bit longer. What is your general approach when you do have this higher blood test, and what medicines should we be starting and or increasing?
Yeah, it's a really good question. So this is an in and out balance, and so we have to think about it that way. So, and I think you need to think about it on both sides. Otherwise, it's very hard to be successful. So you work through methods to reduce the input. Again, renal dietitian is an integral part of our team. And I'm really fortunate because at least on my team, our dietitians are outstanding. So you need a really good review. You need to take a very, very careful diet history. You need to make sure that you have a conversation with families about these types of foods we really need to start limiting or even potentially avoiding. So that's the reduced input component. If it's an infant, if they're not already on breast milk or on that special formula that I mentioned, we're going to maybe have to think about a change. I've got a couple of kids over the age of one who are on that infant formula because it's just better. There's no sort of pediatric version of those formulas. There are adult renal formulas, which pack a lot of nutrition. Some of those are not super well tolerated by a 1.5 or a 2-year-old, but those are options. And so the input, it's important to work on the input side. And then you have to think about what you can do on the output side. And so can I safely back off on the RAS inhibition? Or is that not a good choice because it's going to make the patient have more proteinuria and more problems with their blood pressure control? But occasionally I've done it. I've sometimes reduced those doses and added a different antihypertensive medication to get at least the blood pressure under control. But it can be a challenge if there's a lot more protein excretion at that point. Can my patient really come off of a calcineurin inhibitor like tacrolimus? If this is a renal transplant patient who's at nearing the end of their kidney transplant life, which is why we're having renal dysfunction at this point, if I cut off the tacrolimus right then, maybe they'll lose their allograft immediately, and I don't want that. But can I go to my transplant colleagues, and maybe is there an alternative? There are other immunosuppressive medications which are not calcineurin inhibitors and don't have that same negative impact on potassium excretion. So maybe that's something that we could think about doing. In this case, I'd review very carefully what RAS inhibition I might be using, because I would anticipate in an FSGS patient that's part of my treatment plan. And I'd review calcineurin inhibition and maybe try to make some adjustments and see if I can get away with a little bit less. So that's the output part, where you optimize the ability to excrete, and then you can augment excretion by adding diuretic into the program. And then you have to make sure that you don't accidentally make the patient volume deplete. And so you have to think about ways to keep track of that. So it's, chronic nephrology management for chronic kidney disease, whether it's potassium related or anything else. I've often said it's like a pan balance, right? You sort of put a little bit on this side and a little bit on that side, and you try to find the way that it balances. The problem is that this pan balance has about 12 pans on it. And so figuring out how to get it all balanced is kind of tricky. And as we sort of alluded to beforehand, if you can't, maybe it's time to think about dialysis.
And would you add sodium zirconium to these patients as part of your PANs?
That is a really interesting question. And I have, over the years, before patiramer or sodium zirconium cyclosilicate were available, and all we had was sodium polystyrene sulfonate, I was very hesitant to do it. A couple of reasons. First of all, it added a lot of sodium to the patient, and that just worked against us in terms of volume management, blood pressure, edema. Second of all, nobody wanted to take it. It tasted terrible. It's like drinking liquid sand. It's just awful. So nobody wanted to do it anyway. The kids with the G-tubes, it was a little bit easier to get them to take it, but nobody really liked tasting it. And I always, it's interesting, I was always afraid it sent the wrong message. I don't know if that's the right phrasing, but I worried, especially with some of my teens, that they'd say, well, I can just ignore the diet thing. I'll just take one extra hit of my K-binder and it'll all be cool. And that's a recipe for arrhythmia. And I didn't like that. I didn't like that. Our adult colleagues are using patiramer and using sodium zirconium cyclosilicate more in the chronic setting as part of the armamentarium to control potassium in their adult chronic kidney disease patients. It'll be really interesting. Some of my colleagues in pediatric nephrology have started to do it, and it'll be interesting to see if that starts to be done more. I haven't personally done it yet, but these are good tools, and figuring out how to use them best and safest is going to be interesting.
And when you are making those adjustments, like, when should we be repeating those? Say that, you know, the lab came back at 5.8. Are you waiting for the next 3-month lab, or are you repeating that in a week once you kind of do your adjustment?
Again, very context dependent. There are some patients where I will recheck it in a week. So if I went up on the lisinopril from 5 to 10 just last week, and I rechecked it now, and the K is 6.2, I'd probably say to myself, that's not good. Drop back to where you were beforehand. Let's repeat this potassium about a week. We'll see where we are. The lower the GFR, the more, the tighter the time frame to recheck. If it's been mostly 5.8 and it's 5.9, I actually might shrug and I might wait for the quarterly labs. So I think there's a lot of variability in there. But if you're not sure and you're anxious, check it sooner. And I checked it a lot sooner when I was earlier in my career. And as I've seen a little more, and you kind of get the vibe for how this is going to play, there may be a little bit more flexibility, but you always err on the side of the safety of your patient.
I think we've been doing a lot of like really great outpatient management. And I want to go back to something you said about at some point you need to maybe send a patient to the ED and maybe admit them for a hospital stay. And I want to touch more on like tailoring our hospital management to a patient with CKD. So obviously we have our nephrology colleagues, our pharmacists, our nutritionists. But in general, when I think about IV fluids, feeds, you know, plus minus TPN, medications, like what are things I need to be careful of or specific things you'd recommend in patients with CKD?
Yeah, I think probably the most important thing to remember is that all the regular tricks don't apply, right? So every trick we use, whether it's an equation to calculate maintenance fluids, assuming you believe in maintenance fluids at all, that concept, you know, how much sodium or potassium or anything are they supposed to get in their PN on a daily basis, whatever those tricks, equations, calculators online, that well-worn page in your little book where you wrote something down in your residency, it doesn't apply if there's not normal physiology, right? Almost all of those tricks are based on assumptions about normal renal physiology and the way that the kidney is going to be able to respond to things that we do. And if the kidney is maybe not so capable of responding, those assumptions are out the window. So it's sometimes you have to back up and really go to first principles and not just use an equation or not just use something standard. You know, there's no standard lights in PN for a renal patient. There's no standard intravenous fluid for a renal patient. You need to figure out what that individual patient means. So that would be my recommendation, is that when you admit these patients, you would look very much at how they've been trending. You'd make a judgment about what their renal function is like. And in collaboration with your nephrology colleagues, you would be able to come up with an individualized plan. If you're working in a place where maybe you don't have pediatric nephrology support, which can absolutely happen, right? And because there's a relatively small number of pediatric nephrologists around the country, and smaller hospitals, smaller cities, community hospitals may not have a nephrologist on their staff, a pediatric nephrologist on their staff. So if you're in that situation, always err on the side of less. And if you recognize from a potassium standpoint, for example, if your standard intravenous fluid that you like to use has 20 milliequivalents a liter of KCl in it, don't do that. Too high potassium, especially in a renal patient, could happen really quickly and could get you into big trouble really quickly. So always err on the side of less. If in a couple of days the potassium is down to 3, not as bad as it being up to 8. And so that's an error I'd rather err on the side of too low than too high. And if you're following and you're monitoring, you should be able to keep track. So I think recognizing and respecting how quickly things could go bad, because none of the assumptions hold, will keep you honest and make sure you do the right thing for your patient.
Okay. So being mindful of electrolytes and things, maybe using like a hypotonic fluid perhaps, or just making sure that the feed you're giving, for instance, if you don't have their home feed at a more community hospital, just kind of like be mindful of their excretion abilities.
I think that if you're, from a feeding standpoint, if you know that they're supposed to be on a low potassium formula or feed, and you don't have access to that, yeah, be mindful. That's a patient where you might say, well, I admitted you for bronchiolitis, but you know, you happen to have mild chronic kidney disease, I'll just give you this other formula, you'd be okay. You might not be checking labs on all the other bronchiolytics in your hospital, but maybe that one you have to, because you got to keep track, because you recognize you may have perturbed the system, because unfortunately we don't have the resource. Intravenous fluids, I would avoid potassium in any of my renal patients, unless they're a chronic renal patient who has increased potassium excretion. So some of my patients with tubulopathies actually lose a lot of potassium really, really quickly, and then they need some, so it gets a little tricky. So just because it's got the nephrology stamp on it, yeah, you need to dig in a little bit more and see where you are. Hypotonic intravenous fluids versus isotonic intravenous fluids is a whole other story, and very happy to come back and have that conversation another day. Hard one.
Yeah, who knew there's so much drama in intravenous fluids?
Yes, it does.
We've talked a lot about treatment, management of CKD and hyperkalemia and kind of electrolyte disturbances, both inpatient, outpatient. And I'm wondering if you see any inequities along like race, SES, kind of other determinants of health, social determinants of health lines in your patients in this realm.
It's an incredibly important question, and the answer is yes, we do. And a lot of the risks for chronic disease are all tied up in social determinants of health. And while the most common cause of chronic kidney disease in pediatrics are congenital anomalies of the kidney and urinary tract, and we don't really think that's associated with socioeconomic status or social determinants, although there are a couple of signals. But there are some renal diseases that certainly are exacerbated by the problems in socioeconomic status and social determinants of health. And overwhelmingly, in my mind, food turns out to be the big issue. And if a family is food insecure, how are they going to be able to follow this specialized diet that we're pushing so hard for their child with chronic kidney disease. How are we going to make sure that we can optimize nutrition while also limiting exposure to some of these higher risk foods? We tend to have more challenges with sodium intake because so much of the inexpensive food is higher in sodium content, but we sometimes don't have knowledge of what the potassium content is going to be. And if you are food insecure and struggling to make sure that there's any food at all, being careful maybe about one member of your family and them needing a special diet, that can be really challenging if you're struggling to make sure that there's food for everybody. We have at our institution, one of my colleagues actually started a food pantry to try to help our chronic kidney disease and dialysis patients, because we recognize that the rates of food insecurity were very, very high. Her work has been really important and I think sort of been transformative in the nephrology community to think about this in ways that we haven't beforehand. Concerns of potassium management are one component. It's a big deal and we really need to think about it.
So I really appreciate you spending all this time talking to us for two whole episodes that our listeners will enjoy. I was wondering if there were any other last remaining thoughts, comments before we finish this episode with you.
No, I first of all, thank you for the opportunity. I really appreciate it. And I hope your listeners find it interesting and motivating to learn more. I always say treat your patient, not the numbers, as I said beforehand. And I said, you know, maybe potassium is the one place you really do have to think about the number, but we're still treating patients. And if we remember that, I think that'll tend to point us in the right direction.
Awesome. Is there anything you'd like to plug as far as anything we should go to, anything our listeners should think about, anything along those lines?
I'd say that I'm not big on plugs. Nephrology is great. Come, you know, call me.
Perfect. Go nephrology. So thank you so much for joining us. Thank you so much for walking through hyperkalemia in multiple different fashions, whether it be the acute setting or the chronic setting. And listeners, please definitely consider pediatric nephrology as your specialty of choice. And we'll talk to you next time. Thanks again.
Thank you.
All right, y'all. Thanks for sticking with us for two whole episodes. This is another episode of The Cribsiders.
It's for the kids.
Get show notes and sign up for our weekly Knowledge Food Formula Feeds newsletter on our website at www.thecribsiders.com.
We are committed to providing you with high-value practice-changing knowledge, and to do that, we need your feedback. So please subscribe, rate, and review the show on Apple Podcasts or contact us at thecribsiders@gmail.com. Special thanks for our producer of this episode, Dr. Angela Wyzang, and our wonderful social media team on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. I've been Sam Mazur.
I've been Angela Wyzang.
And this has been Chris DiChumanchu. Thank you, and good night. And now, the bonus everyone's been waiting for, an AI-written poem about hyperkalemia. Beneath the moon's cold gaze, within night's silent veil, lies a tale of dread that makes the stoutest heart quail. A whisper of doom in the veins of youth does creep, hyperkalemia's shadow in potassium's keep. Too high, the doctors cry in hushed and hurried tones, as potassium's rise brings forth the children's moans. With urgency they gather in the lamplight's ghostly glow, to banish this grim specter that beneath the flesh does grow. Calcium, like a knight, rides forth in gleaming might, to stabilize the heart, to lead them through the night. Insulin, a mage, with glucose at its side, urges cells to open for potassium to hide. Amidst these arcane arts, the diuretics flow, a river to expel, to make the danger go. And should these measures falter, the dialysis machine stands ready in the shadows to cleanse the blood unseen. Oh, somber is the night and heavy is the toll, but steadfast is the vigil to mend the ailing soul. And thus the battle rages neath Poe's watchful eyes, till dawn breaks over the ward and clear the young skies. It was Edgar Allan Poe was in the front. So there you guys go.
Wow, a major round of applause for that. I'm quite moved.
Yeah, that was pretty impressive, actually.
All right, guys. Have a good one.